Studio 360.
There's a classic old urban diner that I'm pretty sure you're familiar with. It's been depicted with James Dean inside, with Santa Claus, with Stewie from Family Guy, with Darth Vader, and probably many, many more. And it's been sung about and written about, and your college roommate probably had it on her wall. But before this diner was seared into our minds, it existed only in the head of one person. An artist, a middle-aged guy, painting in Lower Manhattan under a giant skylight right after the bombing of Pearl Harbor. For this latest segment in our Peabody Award-winning series on American icons, Sarah Lilly traces the birth and ongoing life of a very American painting.
Edward Hopper's 1942 work, Nighthawks. I don't even want to describe it because you know this image. Even if you think you don't, really, you do. Okay, here we go. It's a city corner at night, and the street is dead. The image is wide and rectangular, and on the right half, there's this Depression-era diner with a curving plate glass front. Inside, these pale yellow walls and just a lunch counter that's shaped like a boomerang. The lighting is bright and unnatural and even a little dreadful. It spills out onto the sidewalk. The joint is near empty. The counter attendant, in a white food service cap, appears to be rinsing his hands. And at the rear curve of the counter, facing you, is a man in a suit and hat. Beside him, a woman in a red dress. They don't look at each other. At the near flank of the counter sits another man on a stool. He's in the exact same dark suit and hat. His back is towards you, so you can't see his face. It all just begs the question,
who are these four people?
That's Arden Reed, the late art scholar and proponent of the so-called slow art movement.
The man and woman seated in the middle of the painting certainly appear to be a couple, otherwise they wouldn't be seated that closely. And yet they don't seem to be interacting at all. And what about the man opposite?
You just have no idea. And while you're wondering, some odd points start to register.
There's no door into this diner. It's a piece of glass that wraps around from one side to the other. So on the one hand, we're given access to this scene, and on the other hand, we're excluded from it.
There's obviously a very voyeuristic quality to Hopper. It's almost like they're in a fishbowl, you know?
Carter Foster worked at the Whitney Museum for 11 years and curated a major Hopper exhibit in 2013. He's currently deputy director of curatorial affairs at the Blanton Museum in Austin, Texas.
It is quite cinematic and dramatic. I think the lighting is very dramatic.
This light, apparently at the time, fluorescent lighting was new, and it casts a kind of cold but intense light over the whole scene and then extends back into the street.
And I think, as with like the best of his work, it sort of straddles the line between a surreal or dreamlike quality and a realism that anchors you down.
Even the coffee cups are lonely. It's like he reduced it down to the absolute minimum of what needed to be there.
Charlotte Eierman is an art historian and curator who is director of the art collection at J.P. Morgan Chase.
It's a masterful painting. The rigor of the geometry and the balance of the composition, the kind of grandeur of it is very much dialed into much older traditions of art history.
When he painted Nighthawks, Hopper was 59 and already making his own art history. He'd been featured in shows at major museums like the Whitney, the Met, and MoMA. But though he'd been living in New York for decades, he always cherished his time as a young man in Paris.
This kind of theme of people together but separate, convened in an urban space like a cafe, does go back to that 19th century French tradition of which Manet and Degas are, I think, the most important. And later, of course, Van Gogh would paint the night cafe and a very similar kind of palette. So I think Hopper's nodding to that.
There's no question that Hopper knew the painting, that he saw it in person.
Gail Levin has been studying and writing books about Hopper for over 40 years. She's a professor at Baruch College and considered by many to be the expert on Hopper.
I think the palette is very much related to Van Gogh's Night Cafe. I know he knew it and saw it before he painted Nighthawks. He knew it well.
The Night Cafe also has a late night, almost headachey feel. A paltry smattering of leftover patrons, sharp shadows on the floor from glaring overhead lamps. Smack in the middle of the cafe is an empty billiards table, just yawning in abandon. Van Gogh once called it the ugliest painting he had made in his life. But Hopper may have been drawn to its feeling of menace, quietly on the boil.
The theme of that violence could happen, could break out. Van Gogh wrote about that to his brother. And then the Hemingway that we know Hopper read and loved, Ernest Hemingway's short story, The Killers.
In The Killers, two hired thugs stalk a nearly empty diner at dusk, waiting to ambush a regular who is their target. Here's Stacy Keach reading from the audiobook.
"What do you do here nights?"
Al asked.
"They eat the dinner," his friend said. "They all come here and eat the big dinner."
"That's right,"
George said. "So you think that's right?" Al asked George.
"Sure."
"You're a pretty bright boy, aren't you?"
"Sure,"
said George. "Well, you're not."
Al and his quote-unquote friend proceed to intimidate and ultimately terrorize the manager and a lone customer at the counter. Hopper was hooked.
And that gave him a certain theme, the idea of people in a cafe, uneasy, with violence about to happen.
After an hour, the gangster's target hasn't yet shown, so they leave, clearly planning on continuing their hunt the next day. The end. It's perversely ungratifying, and it forces you to live with not knowing what will happen. Hopper always remembered it, and he took the power of that question mark even further by not providing any backstories either. Who are his people? You'll never know.
It can give you a sense of, I don't know if anxiety is the right word, but you know, the reason people are drawn to Hopper in general is because there is this level of ambiguity that allows you to complete the story. He left a lot open and left things an unanswered question.
You know, he'd been an illustrator. That was one of my big discoveries. He used to be paid 25 cents an hour to watch movies and make publicity posters. He was a real cinema aficionado, and he could go to many movies in one day. It's a pastime that he developed very early.
And he'd continued to watch all kinds of movies, French cinema, Hollywood films. Late 1941, when he started Nighthawks, was just as film noir was starting to take shape. The year of Citizen Kane, The Maltese Falcon, and then, of course...
Here is the motion picture record released by the United States Navy. On December 7th, 1941, Japan, like its infamous Axis partners, struck first and declared war afterwards.
And Joe, in her diaries, Josephine, his wife, was writing about the anxiety that the Germans were going to bomb New York and that Edward was busy working on this painting and he wouldn't even obey the blackout rules. Once he got the impetus to paint it and knew what he wanted to put on it, it came within 6 weeks.
When you think about the moment of its making, you know, we were halfway through the war at that point. It's a time of incredible personal and collective, you know, sacrifice and trauma.
So, you know, all of a sudden, Nighthawks become something that is much more psychologically complex.
Andrew Walker heads the Amon Carter Museum in Fort Worth. He was a curator for years at the Art Institute of Chicago, which is the only owner Nighthawks has ever known.
Think about who was also impacting the art world in that time, not only from the psychological worlds of Jung and Freud and others, but also from, you know, somebody like Hitchcock. I mean, they were all interconnected in some ways. For whatever reason, he got it all.
Like, he wasn't trying to make a filmic painting, but he did.
The creation of Nighthawks dovetailed so seamlessly with the birth of film noir that to untangle who was influencing whom is sort of beside the point. Take The Big Sleep, which was written by Raymond Chandler in 1939 and made into perhaps the classic film noir in 1946, starring Humphrey Bogart.
Sometimes I wonder what strange fate brought me out of the storm to that house that stood alone in the shadows. As I probed into its mysteries, every clue told me a different story. But each had the same ending, murder.
The hovering veils of violence, sex, maybe even depravity, take you right back to the atmosphere of Nighthawks.
You know, it's such a different imagery of Americans than what you would expect to see by the 1950s and 60s, with the kind of glorification of suburban life, of the young family, the Life magazine cover with, you know, the very domestic scene.
Elizabeth Cohen is a historian at Harvard who specializes in 20th century America.
Remember, we're coming out of a Great Depression where there's very little building, and then a war where there were all kinds of shortages and not very much building. So you get these soldiers coming back, people who delayed marriages, delayed having children, and all of a sudden they need homes. And we didn't choose to build a lot of housing in cities. Instead, the strategy for metropolitan development was to develop suburban communities. And we did that with very clear federal policies. So many of the people who would have gone to see this painting by the 1950s, 60s, 70s would have viewed it as outsiders of a sort.
I think loneliness was projected by viewers onto Hopper, who really didn't ever feel lonely. I think he relished his solitude. He liked escape.
Drawing was really crucial to his practice, and Hopper did use mirrors to draw himself for this painting. He set up double mirrors so he could see himself from the back. The mirror that he used is still in his studio at number 3 Washington Square.
All right, so I am walking around on a sweltering summer day, and I'm just heading over to where Edward Hopper lived for the bulk of his adult life. It's this beautiful red brick, I'm standing in front of it now. It's a beautiful red brick townhouse, really amazing, just on the northern edge of Washington Square in Greenwich Village.
This was the easel that he painted most of his major works on.
Amanda and Lawrence works for NYU, which now owns the red brick townhouse at number 3. On the top floor, with his wife, Hopper lived and worked in a one-bedroom apartment from 1913 until his death in 67. Its main room is like a luminous garret in the sky, with huge slanted skylights and gray-painted floors. It's fantastically well-preserved.
Because the easel's in the middle of the room, you kind of have the sense that, like, maybe he'll walk in at any moment. And he'll be like, you know, get out, and I'm going to paint.
So I'm picturing all, I mean, there's so many paintings I'm picturing sort of being birthed on this easel.
And then just so you know, too, like, so this is the model stand, and this mirror is the mirror that he used. And obviously Joe was 4'11", so she would stand on the model stand, because she was his model, and then he would be able to see
all the angles.
Something really crucial to Hopper in general is point of view and where actually the spectator is in space. And in some cases, it's not possible for the spectator to be standing on the ground. They'd have to be floating in the air.
Almost 4 decades after Nighthawks, Ridley Scott was in production on a new film. It was about a dark city, about moving through it while up in the air. It was about the future.
A new life awaits you in the off-world colony. The chance to begin again in a golden land of opportunity and adventure. New climate, recreational facilities.
They don't advertise for killers in a newspaper. That was my profession. Ex-cop. Ex-Blade Runner. Ex-killer.
Of course, Blade Runner is only one of so many projects that reference Nighthawks as a spark of influence. The modern noir of L.A. Confidential is one of my favorites.
The Wheel of Fortune.
Looks like the cook drew a handgun and set it off. The rest were killed in the men's room.
The Night Owl Massacre. This is a heinous crime that requires swift resolution. Six victims. One of them, one of our own.
Several films and TV shows had scenes actually set inside the painting. So irresistible, right?
Every time it rains, it rains.
There was Pennies from Heaven, starring Steve Martin Pennies and Bernadette Peters in 1981, The End of Violence by Wim Wenders, and even that 70s show. Tom Waits named an album after it.
Nighthawks at the diner, Emma's 49er. There's a rendezvous of strangers around a coffee in a night.
It directly inspired literature by the likes of Joyce Carol Oates and Stephen King, paintings by Red Groom's Banksy, and of course, Gottfried Helnwein's Boulevard of Broken Dreams, with James Dean and Marilyn Monroe at the counter. Oh, you know the one. So naturally, fans started actually looking for the real place.
One of the famous things that's always said about Nighthawks is a quote by Hopper where he says, it was inspired by a restaurant on Greenwich Avenue where two streets meet.
Gotta wait for the cars to pass.
Well, here, come over here so we're facing away from the street.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right now we are walking up Greenwich Avenue. It cuts across all the regular streets of Manhattan, making angles. And, you know, everybody knows that it was kind of like a triangular restaurant. So naturally, it would be at probably one of those triangles, right?
Bob Egan has a blog called Pop Spots NYC and a book called Pop Culture New York City. In both, he obsessively sleuths out the real locations of pop cultural images, mostly album covers and films, that have particularly haunted him, like Nighthawks.
I always loved Edward Hopper. He's kind of like the rock star of painters of, you know, for America. I go to the library and you can find where, let's say he painted this in, I forget exactly the year.
42.
You go to the library and they got every single store listed going up Greenwich Avenue by number. So I circled all the ones that were restaurants and then I went back and I photographed every single corner, and there's probably 22 of them along Greenwich Avenue. And it came down basically to two of them, which were Greenwich Avenue 11th Street and Greenwich Avenue 12th Street.
I found that there was a restaurant called Crawford Lunch that was where two streets meet at this angle. But it's not in any way, it doesn't look like Nighthawks, the painting.
The little florist store at the corner of West 11th Street and Greenwich fits the bill in many different ways.
Despite much debate, most experts agree that there is no 100% match to a real space that ever existed, but rather an amalgam based on Hopper's long relationship to the neighborhood.
You know, I've read all these crazy blogs. Somebody thinks they know just where he got the coffee urn. They appear in his illustration. He already had them. He had so many details of Nighthawks in his own commercial work. It's just a matter of synthesizing, you know, this great soup in his brain sort of coming to a boil, and out comes Nighthawks. I think he was very clever that he sets up this stage for our fantasies.
Maybe its scale and size has something to do with it.
The dimensions are broad, 5 feet across and less than 3 feet tall. So it's almost as if he were anticipating the widescreen ratio our modern screens have embraced.
And then it fell into this notion of popular culture.
Yeah, then the parodies of them become famous, and the takeoffs.
I mean, think about it. This is a work that has influenced the Simpsons as well as artists, and so it has this power that transcends any moment of its own inspiration, because people appropriate it and they understand it in a context that is far beyond what its original intention was.
What's interesting about Nighthawks is that it had the Hopper estate renewed the copyright. Certainly the image would not have
proliferated as much as it has, it started popping up in all kinds of places.
Gregory Clarick is an attorney in New York who's navigated some high-profile cases in art and entertainment, including a forgery intrigue that took down a major New York gallery. He and I discussed all the pieces of commercial swag, the posters, the coffee mugs, the mouse pads. A recent search on Amazon offered up 242 entries. All these companies have been able to ride Nighthawk's popularity all the way to the bank, royalty-free, because it's been in the public domain since 1970.
What I remember most is as a child playing a Parker Brothers board game that was called Masterpiece. And in Masterpiece, you bought and sold and auctioned and traded various artworks.
Be one of them, the flamboyant bidders in the exclusive high-tension world of international art.
100,000, do I hear 100?
100,000? 250,000. Which is what Parker Brothers' new Masterpiece game is all about. Cezanne's, Monet's, Rembrandt's, they're all here, and you bid for them.
Sometimes I have a vivid memory of often fighting with my brother and sister over the buying and selling and auctioning of the Nighthawk's painting.
Oh my gosh, yes. I mean, I remember playing Masterpiece as a game when I was a kid in the 70s, and Nighthawks was always a part of that story.
I had the Nighthawks on my wall at college and stuff.
In a way, Nighthawks hit a perfect storm for blockbuster achievement. Between the Depression and the war, film noir, which was black and white but Hopper delivered in color, modern psychology, suburban ennui, mass production. Nighthawks looks like entertainment, but holds you like art. It's the connective tissue between the French Impressionists, Ridley Scott, and Family Guy.
You know, I have a kind of way of thinking about art that works of art are in dialogue. The dialogues change depending on, you know, what's happening in the moment when the painting was made, what's happening in the moment when you see it.
If I'm mounting an exhibition here at the Eamon Carter, I want Edward Hopper to be a part of it because people will care. Sorry, I'm sorry to get all passionate.
It's fun for me to think about all this.
You know, a work of art is a kind of constantly renewing resource. And you think about, you know, we all have to recharge our phones all the time because they run out of batteries, right? They run out of juice. Works of art like this, at this level, never run out of juice.
Nighthawks at the diner, Emma's 49er. There's a rendezvous of strangers around a coffee in the night. All the gypsy hacks and the insomniacs, now the paper's been read.
Sarah Lilly produced our story.
Now the waitress said, eggs and sausages and sausage.
Our American Icons series is supported by the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Hash browns are easy, chili